Hey everyone, this is 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. This episode, I'm joined by former NHL goaltender, outdoor game specialist, Ty Conklin. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and rate on iTunes, Spotify, and all the streaming channels. You can find me, of course, on all the socials at MikeMcKenna56. Football might be over, but the NBA, college basketball, and the NHL are all in full swing. And the only place you should be betting on these sports, you know where to go, betonline.ag. Basketball. Man, I like all the state schools, Mizzou, Wisconsin, Virginia. You got to look for the underdog. Those teams are about mid-pack right now. And keep an eye on TCU. That's an undercover sleeper that I think is going to be coming in hot here in the next couple weeks. Bet Online even covers awards, TV shows, and reality TV. Imagine placing that bet on Real Housewives. Get some intel from your family that watches. Place a bet. Maybe you make a little cash on it. Makes it fun. Bet Online has hundreds of props with real-time odds on almost anything you can imagine. And of course, the online casino. 24 hours, never closes, always open. So head to the website, use your mobile device to sign up today, and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's betonline.ag. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. All right, let's kick it over to the show. Here's Ty Conklin.
Ty, it's cool catching up. I'm happy that you came on to do this. First things first, I really want to know why you became a goaltender. What drew you to the position?
I think it probably started around when I was like 5 or 6. My dad got us down to the rinks. It was mostly outdoor stuff. And probably year 2 or 3, I somehow talked the coach into letting me play in goal. I'm not sure why. I think my dad had to do over again. He would have really like pushed me into being a forward or something.
He would have seen what's coming.
I was, stopping. Who was the guy? So, remind me who the goalie was in the Olympics, Ray LeBlanc.
Yes.
Ray LeBlanc. I remember
because he had that USA mask with the eagle on it. ITEC 961.
He had a huge, huge run in the Olympics. I remember watching him and pretending I was him down in the basement with my brother with tennis balls. Got in a game and then the next year kind of just played goalie. And from there on, I was just a goalie. So I probably really started playing goal full time when I was 9 or 10, something like that. And then, you're stuck once you get to a certain age.
So it's interesting for you that it's like your frame of reference was the USA team. Most kids, it's somebody from an NHL team. Do you think being in Alaska maybe kind of affected your mindset and how you viewed the position in the sport?
Well, yeah, I think it's affected a lot of things. No, I think it's just, that's kind of what I remembered. I remember growing up really liking the Chicago Blackhawks, loved Eddie Belfour. But we didn't have like you grew up in St. Louis. I didn't have a St. Louis Blues in my backyard.
Right. No hometown team.
I don't have the Maple Leafs or the Canadians, in my backyard or that you're like rooting for. So I don't know that I never really, to be honest, never really had a team. So I never had these big aspirations of playing in the NHL either. Ever, to be honest. It wasn't like, some kid growing up in Metro Toronto is like, he's playing in the NHL for sure, 100%.
Oh, yeah. And their parents know it.
That's it. So I didn't have that. But and maybe that helped me. I'm not sure.
So it made everything gravy down the road. I mean, did you even have an eye on college hockey? Because that's one thing you did have in Alaska. You had Fairbanks with the team. Alaska, Anchorage had a team. Did at least kind of give you something to shoot for by the time you went to Shattuck, St. Mary's, and moving on to UNH?
Yeah, I definitely. So watching UAA when I was a kid, and I think the program actually is, I'm not sure if the program's even around anymore. I think it's kind of done. But it was huge. It was like an impossible ticket to go to a UAA hockey game. And they were independent. So they had, like Minnesota would come up, North Dakota would come up. The place was packed. They had really good teams. So I knew college hockey. College hockey was like what I wanted to do for sure. And then going obviously down to Shattuck for my junior year and then continuing on playing junior hockey was all kind of with an eye towards getting a Division I scholarship, really.
What point in your life did you learn how to fly? I mean, I can't believe that you've been a pilot your whole career, but I don't know when that actually started for you, man. Like you used to fly into summer training camps, but I'm thinking
I only did that for a year or two.
Okay, but
for a year or two I did that. Yeah.
But growing up in Alaska, that's a normal thing, right? Everybody's got a bush plane. You go hop from place to place.
Yeah. So I live right around the corner from Lake Hood, which is and it's not just a big seaplane base, but it's, you know, there's it's like having a boat out here. I live on the East Coast now. It's like having a boat out here. And I'd always, for two or three summers, I worked for a flying fishing service. You know, they flew into different fish camps. They did a bunch of sightseeing tours and stuff like that. So I was always around planes. I just liked them. I got my pilot's license. Actually, I think I got my pilot's license the year of the lockout. Was that 2004?
Yeah.
I finished it up and I had a plane a year and a half later, maybe a little Super Cub. Loved it, man. You should have seen me. I remember flying into Pennsylvania to skate in the summers. Cause you and I would usually run into each other skating
with Chris Economo's place.
But, I'd stay out there for a week and I'd always catch you either at the end of when you were in there or I was, you know, I was leaving or whatever, but I'd go out there 2-3 times a summer. And it was always, I do remember trying to get Chris into the plane and he was not excited about it at all. Not excited.
Is it making you nervous to be behind the stick? Like I don't have any reference of flying a plane. No, I mean, to me, that's a foreign thing.
No, it's great. Which is strange coming from St. Louis too, because St. Louis has got a great aviation history, obviously.
Right.
But I mean, there's a, where I kept my plane in Creve Coeur down there in the river valley. The place is awesome. Yeah. But it has its moments where it can get a little sporty, but you know, you try and that's not the way it's supposed to be.
That's wild. So you still have a plane now?
I do not. No, no.
Oh, bummer.
It didn't fly enough. And yeah,
that's expensive.
But you know what? Frankly, I don't even miss it. I'm sure there's one day where the bug will bite me again, but that's not right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go back. So go to Shattuck, go to Green Bay, go to UNH. You said there wasn't any frame of reference for the NHL. But at some point it had to click that, you know what? I'm probably on people's radar. Did that happen by the USHL? Was it at UNH? When did you start to get that?
That was when I was at UNH. And I definitely didn't think it in. I actually remember having a conversation with my junior coach, Don Granato. I think we were like, he was going on a scouting trip, like 30 or 45 minutes away. And I didn't have anything to do that day. So I'm like, well, I'll just go with you. And we're chatting and I'm asking him, he's talking about the draft and about the NHL. And I'm like, coach, how many guys are going to play in the NHL? I mean, nobody's going to play in the NHL. He's like, well, you know, like there's a chance somebody in this league is going to play in the NHL or a couple guys. Like guys leave, they have to be replaced by other guys. You know, like it's just the way it works, which is completely obvious, I suppose. But, you know, you don't think about it like that when you're that age and you're just kind of focused on getting a college scholarship at that point. But I guess when I remember kind of looking around when I was probably after my sophomore year in college thinking, you know what, I'm probably about as good as most of the guys in college.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a good chunk of them anyway.
And you're on a good team, which helps. You're winning games. You've got some juice behind you.
Yeah. And UNH was the program was really, really strong. We're playing in NCAA Final Fours. And
yeah,
we had just lost the national championship game in overtime. So I didn't necessarily I'm definitely playing in the NHL, but it looked and I said, well, I might have a future playing after. Whatever level that is, I'm not sure, but that I'd be able to play after. I was pretty sure of that.
Was it a big shock going to that enormous ice at UNH, or did you have experience with it? That's the biggest sheet of ice I think I've ever skated on. And then, of course, when you get scored on, they throw the fish at you.
Yeah. Well, they didn't throw the fish at me.
No, you were on the right team.
I felt like throwing the fish at me, but no, you know, I got really used to it. We had an Olympics, at least one Olympic size rink, maybe two in Anchorage, in the Sullivan Arena's Olympic size, where
UAA. I played there against Anchorage or Alaska Aces in the ECHL.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's big. It doesn't feel as big necessarily as Whittemore Center. But no, you get used to it. It's the sheet you skate on every day. You know, I don't know how much it helps when you're going and playing like in the playoffs and all that, you know, you're playing it, you know, a big game and, you know, playing Boston University or playing BC down there or going up to Maine and playing up there. It's a whole different ice surface. And, you know, you can tell that it's tough for guys to kind of catch up to the speed. Yeah. The speed is different, but the big sheet didn't bother me at all. I mean, it's all the same for a goalie, to be honest with you.
I mean, the shots are usually coming from that same close proximity. They're not chucking them at you from way out on the boards on an Olympic sheet.
No. Shot from the point goes in without a screen, you need to get a new goalie.
You're not playing the next game. Well, what made you choose Edmonton when you got done with UNH? Because you were undrafted. I'm sure you had some options.
Yeah, I did. It seemed like the best fit at the time, I guess. A lot of different reasons. But yeah, it had a lot of highs, a lot of times that were difficult too in Edmonton. I think that would have been the same for everywhere. I think that's kind of like everybody's career or most guys' career is, you know, you got some really good parts and you got some parts that are more difficult to get and more challenging that you have to work through. And that was the case for me in Edmonton, but it was a great start for sure.
Good place to go in Hamilton too. I mean, I know you got games with Edmonton that first year, and I do want to ask about your welcome to the NHL moment, but even before that, going to Hamilton, playing for Claude Julien, a good transition to pro hockey.
I felt so. Yeah. I really liked Claude as a coach. He was hard. He was tough, but he was very, very fair from my perspective anyway. We had good teams again in Hamilton. Both years. My second year, we were a split affiliation with Montreal, and we ended up losing in game 7 in the Calder Cup finals. So, and I think we lost in the conference finals my first year. So we had really good teams, close teams, good guys, and Hamilton's a sneaky, fun town. It was a good spot to play for sure.
Isn't it funny how, like, you think about guys that didn't get the right break or the right luck through their career. If you go to a bad team at the start of your career, especially as a goalie, if you go 10 and 20, you might get buried and it might not even be your own fault. You know, like you had to go through the muck where you had a couple other goalies, you had a split affiliation, and you were still able to bust out of it. So what was your welcome to the NHL moment with the Edmonton Oilers?
Yeah. Well, I think that couple parts of that question. I think that when you talk about opportunity, you know, I mean, you need to have that opportunity, or most guys do anyway. I mean, there are some guys who are so skilled and so much better than everybody else and so clearly deserving that they almost don't even need the opportunity.
They can make it themselves. Yeah, that was not me.
That was not me either. And there's a lot of guys, and you know, there's a point where you have to get that opportunity. You have to take advantage of it and you have to play well. And you have to be prepared when it does come, because it can come at any time. I know I was up, I played a little bit I played probably 3 or 4 games that year. My first year, and it was right away. It was, you know, I was not ready. I thought I was ready, and I actually played well, won a couple games. I played well in all, I think 3 or 4 games I was in, but I mean, looking back now, I'm like, I wasn't even close to being ready.
Knowing what you now know now, right? You're thinking,
right. And then when I got sent down, I'm like, I can't believe I'm getting sent down.
Who was your first game against?
My first start was against Florida Panthers. We ended up winning 6-2, I think, something like that. Yeah, I could not have been more nervous.
What made you nervous about a game? Was it just the overall everything going on, or?
I was always nervous. I was nervous for every game. Didn't matter what game it was. That one in particular, your first NHL start and at home, I think it was a Hockey Night in Canada game, which I really didn't have any frame of reference for how important Hockey Night in Canada was, or how it was kind of a big deal.
I didn't either. I got absolutely lit up on Hockey Night in Canada, and everybody's like, you were on TV. I'm like, yeah, I know. Yeah.
So any event, it was against Florida. We we were the better team all game. We should have won that game. We did. So I felt like I did my job. And yeah, my dad and brother and she was my girlfriend at the time, but wife now, they all made it down for the game. I think they were in Montana at the time. My dad and brother were, so it wasn't too far of a drive. I think they mixed in some skiing after the game, and yeah, it was good.
So you talked about going to a Calder Cup run with Hamilton. Did you know at that point you're probably going to end up in Edmonton the following season after getting all those games and playoffs, carrying the load? And did you feel like you had the momentum behind you at that point going into camp in 2003?
Yeah, I had a one-way contract too the following year.
There it is. There's what helps.
That helped. But yeah, I felt like after that year, just from a playing standpoint, I felt like I was ready.
It's funny how like some guys feel like they're ready right away and then they learn, and others feel like they take forever. And I talked to Peter Budaj a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, yeah, I'm really happy I played those years in the minors because I knew I was ready. Like,
yeah.
It's like, well, wow, man. Like,
you knew he was ready after he played the 2 or 3 years.
Yes. Like, so he actually felt like when he really showed up full time and made the team out of camp. I think that's like, I never had that chance. Like, I never made a team out of camp. You know, like when they tell you to get your own place in the NHL, is that really kind of where you're like, all right, it's go time. I've done this. Put the hammer down.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, it certainly should be. So I played that first year and found a place right away. I think they told me to get a place. I'm sure they told me to get a place. I don't imagine that I would have gone and tried to find a place without them telling me to get a place.
Yeah.
and then I had to, you know, I had, we had the lockout, and I had a very poor year the following year. I had to work my way back to the NHL from the American League. And so that wasn't easy, but I mean, it's interesting that Peter would say that because it's the right way to look at it. Right. I mean, it's the way I saw it, but I don't think I necessarily thought of it that way at that time. Like I was happy to have played in Hamilton for 2 years because it was a great experience. It's fun. I didn't necessarily look at it like, I'm glad I played there because I put the work in and now I know I'm ready. Because I still didn't even know. I thought I was, but I wasn't looking at it that way necessarily. I don't know if I'm explaining it well, but I think if you look back, there's very few guys that don't need 2 or 3 years in the American League.
Yeah, I agree.
Until they're ready, because it's just the expectation and the, you know, having to be at your best every day. It's so important. And, you know, having those ups and downs that you get in the American League, and it's a difficult league to play in.
Oh, it's chaotic.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, it's a little harder than the NHL.
Yeah.
You know, you play on a Friday night, you bus somewhere, you get in at 3 a.m, you play it on Saturday. You don't even know where you're at on Sunday.
No, you're delirious.
Yeah. You're exhausted, and you know, you're still expected to perform.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in the NHL, you first class somewhere, you know, the travel's a piece of cake comparatively, and it's just more difficult. There's more hurdles, I believe, in the American League. So if you can perform there, you should be able to perform in the NHL.
Did you think the lockout hurt your momentum?
Oh yeah, big time. But well, I made a bad decision not playing right away the whole lockout. I should have absolutely 100% played the entire thing. I thought we were going to play personally. So I should have gone to Europe right away. I ended up going to Europe in January, but I should have been there all year. I mean, I still regret not doing that. If I had it to do over, that's the one thing I would have really changed in my career is that.
It's interesting how some guys had different perspectives on it. You know, I've talked to some that thought we were going to play, others thought no chance. And man, it just feels like the union was all over the place and not really streamlining things. Were you very involved in the process, or were you just kind of relying on what you'd heard?
I wasn't very involved. I was a new guy in the league. I didn't know that I felt that it was my place to be overly involved either.
Right.
The way I see those things, it's really difficult, especially in something like that, when you've got 30 billionaires or very successful businessmen make a decision on what they want, you know, from a business perspective, that it's going to be difficult for 750 professional athletes, you know, who have no business.
Not many of them, at least, have a business background.
Right. Yeah, you know, and like we're being, it's difficult to win that battle, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? But it seems like it works out for the players pretty well every time.
We've made a lot of money. Like, yeah. I wouldn't say me personally, yeah. But like in general, I mean,
yeah,
players have made a lot of money off of this. Sometimes you have to realize what is in front of you and take the deal you get sometimes, but
yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily want to dive into that stuff, but yeah, it's just, it was from I thought we were going to play. I really was. I thought it would be like a couple month thing. You know, maybe I was just being naive, but, if I had to do over again, I would have played that year for sure.
Something about your career that people obviously cling to: the goal against in the playoffs, 2006 with the Oilers, miscommunication behind the net, puck gets scored. When, what point did you enter that game? Because it was Markkanen, your goalie partner at the time, or Rolison?
So yeah, he was playing amazing. Probably going to be,
he was lights out. Yeah.
Game one, we're up. It was tied 4-4. We had been up like 3 or 4-0, I think. It's late in the third period. 5 minutes left in the third, 8 minutes. I don't even know how long. There was a kind of like a collision. Rolly hurt his knee. I went in, and did they score in overtime? They didn't score in overtime. That wasn't an overtime goal. That was like,
I can't even remember.
No, it was like with, I've honestly never watched. I have watched the replay just like in passing, but I never really sat down and watched it.
Really?
I don't know. I know what happened.
Sure.
Well,
what did happen exactly? Because people like to scapegoat you, and I've defended you on this for years.
Well, it's game one, so you can't really, like, it's not like it was the series.
Right.
It was a tie game.
Yeah.
But I will say, I thought it was the right play to make. Rolly didn't handle the puck quite as much. I did.
He would still flip the stick over.
Right. And
you could rip it.
And Jason, I mean, I guess if I could do it over again, I would have put it up off the glass and just like seen what happened. But my defenseman, Jason Smith, was coming to me to get the puck, and I kind of just put it through his legs.
Right.
If I remember correctly, I think that's exactly.
Well, it looked like he didn't say anything to you. It looked like he didn't say, leave it, play it, anything.
He might have. I'm not sure. I mean, I just kind of like backhand pass. It may not even have been the right play to make, but in any event, yeah, it was it wasn't awesome. It wasn't a great feeling, but I'm not sure that was necessarily I didn't feel good about it for sure, but it was game one, and it was, yeah, I don't necessarily love talking about it, but
people will always look at the goaltender for the easy excuse.
Yeah, I mean, they can. People on the outside, you know, it's funny though, right, that I think that in a lot of ways, goalies get a free pass, and a lot of times they shouldn't, too. You know, I mean, I think how many times that a goalie let a bad goal up and everybody comes over and taps him on the pads? You know, it's like,
yeah,
you know, goalies are allowed to make mistakes just like everybody else. And they do make mistakes just like everybody else. They let in a bad goal or whatever they do. Just like a guy will make a bad pass up the middle or, you know, a giveaway on the boards. You know, we all make mistakes.
Yeah.
I don't know that you have to necessarily kind of like brush over goalies' mistakes either.
Part of being a teammate though, too. Right. Like I always thought that the goalies get a lot more credit than they deserve a lot too.
You know,
you can face 20 shots and you allowed 2 junkers at the start of the game, but you have a great third period and you're the hero.
Right. Well,
you still allowed 2 junkers at the beginning of the game.
I don't know, feast or famine a little bit in goal, but I think we learn as goalies, and you know this just as well as I do, we learn that pretty quickly, that's just the case. That's the way it is. Right. And learn to live with that stuff.
This was about the same time frame that you saved my career for the first time.
I'm not sure how I did that. You said that.
So we're sitting at Chris Economo's place. You've flown in and you're skating with him. We're sitting on the couch and you've got just a dirty white t-shirt on. Like, this is how vividly I remember this. And it's after my first year pro, which was 2005-06. And I'd led the ECHL in just about everything. I'd been called up to Norfolk on a PTO for a month and a half. And my agent at the time, who I'd had as an advisor since I was like 15, like he was a pretty big dog. But when Nashville didn't sign me coming out of college, you know, he kind of went hands off on it. And after that year on the coast, like I played that well, he told me basically, yeah, if somebody wants you, they're going to come find us. They'll get in touch with us. And I remember saying that to you and you look me square in the eye and you go, you need to fire that fucking guy. Like right now. Like that was your response, like clear as day. And I did. So I went back and I thought on it. And I think about 5 days later, I called up this multimillionaire agent and I'm making $450 a week in the coast. And I said, I think we need to part ways. But that was the best at that time. It was probably the best decision I'd ever made, because the person I ended up with after that, Elaine Waugh,
yeah,
got me jobs all throughout my career that I don't know if somebody who hadn't been willing to really work would have gotten me.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I did anything. I said the easy thing. The difficult thing is
you told me what nobody else had told me. Nobody in the game had told me that.
Making that decision to call the guy, though, that's not an easy conversation to have.
Don't
necessarily know if you're making the right decision. I was lucky. By guy, the agent I had my entire career, Kurt Overhart, was, I mean, he worked extremely hard. Sometimes you could almost argue too hard, but he knew he always had your back, which is what you want from anybody. And I think that most guys that have, you know, relationships, whether it's your agent or teammate, their guys are going to work for him.
Find that about goalie coaches as well. You need them in your corner.
You have to have them in your corner. Yeah. I mean, you also have to have guys who will tell you the truth. Right. But, yeah, I mean, like we were talking earlier, I've got like theories on coaching, just because I've done it too. You know, you either have a guy who's maybe, they're usually younger guys who are very good at teaching the structure of the game.
Technical aspects
of the game. But maybe they have some hockey. A lot of times they don't have a ton of experience necessary playing. And then you've got a guy who is, and they're generally an older guy. Maybe they played a lot. They've got a lot of playing experience. They don't necessarily have that ability to really teach the game from a technical standpoint. And then there's not all that, you know, the guys that can like can mix the two, you know, those guys they're tough to find. They're not always the best. I mean, for me, there were times where I needed a technical guy. Young or old, I guess the age doesn't matter, but a technical guy who is really going to, you know, drive home the technical aspects of the game. And there are times where I really just needed somebody to talk to who had experience, knew exactly what I was going through, and they'd been through it a couple times. You know, just to, you know, you can see what's going on in a guy's head if he's struggling, or you can see if a guy's getting tired and he's getting lazy and playing a certain way. And you can also tell when a guy is like not being honest with himself, that, you know, he tells everybody he's playing okay and he feels good. And then you can tell that he's not playing well. He's not himself for whatever reason. And you can be honest with him. And especially guys that played can be honest and have those conversations too. And they're really helpful a lot of times.
Do you think it's important for goalies to be able to kind of mold their mindset to the goalie coach that they have too, like two-way street?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, I would say it's probably, yeah, I would say it's probably more important certainly for the goalie coach to move towards the player themselves more. But yeah, I think that like, it's certainly helpful for the goalie if he can see that there's a guy who maybe he's not jiving with for whatever reason, and see that if he moves himself a little bit to that guy, understand that guy's just trying to help, that there can be some common ground for sure.
Lots more with Ty Conklin coming, but hey, sneakerheads, I know you're out there. I want to give a brief moment to talk about our newest sponsor, eBay. Whether rare dead stock or the latest release, find the exact shoe you're looking for. Pre-owned, rare, vintage, retro, all available on eBay, just a couple clicks away. As the original sneaker marketplace, eBay's a place to go to find the pair that you've been eyeing. With eBay's authenticity guarantee, your sneakers are meticulously inspected by independent professional authenticators. A team of experienced sneaker authenticators verify the box, logo, stitching, dozens of other inspection points. These things are the real deal. Each sneaker also receives an authenticity guarantee tag that includes a digital stamp of authenticity. You know you're getting the real thing. And it also protects sellers with a verified return process. And for sneaker sellers out there, eBay has eliminated the selling fees on sneakers $100 and up, making it free to sell or flip your collection. So go to ebay.com/sneakers today. eBay, the world's best destination for discovering great value and unique selection. Also like to tell you about the goalie coaching that I've been doing online with 44visionhockey.com. It's awesome. Got a couple of kids now that have really made some strides, and the way it's working is that they upload their games through Live Barn, through Hockey TV. We get them to a program called Instat where I'm able to take all their clips, break them down, draw circles and arrows and descriptions all over them. We upload those little videos, those little clips to their own player page on the 44visionhockey.com website. Each player gets their own page. I've got the login that I can add these videos. They're like Cliff's Notes. You look back at those. They're your reference points for what you need to do to improve your game. Where we really hone in on it, it's in a Zoom meeting. We get together. We pick a time. It's on your schedule that works for both of us. We go over all your game clips, what you could do better, what you're doing really well. Look at it through a pro's eyes, through my own experience, from what I've learned playing, working with different goalie coaches all across the NHL. So go to 44visionhockey.com, put my name in as your coach. I'd love to work with you. And now more with Ty Conklin.
So what was the road back to the NHL like? It didn't last long. I mean, it was more or less a year, year and a half going through the American Hockey League.
Yeah.
But, you know, how did you really fight your way back and end up with that gig in Pittsburgh in 07-08?
So I played for, played 5 years in Edmonton's organization. And then, so it would have been 2005, six, maybe.
Yep.
I was in, I signed with Columbus and started the year in Syracuse and played all right there. We didn't have that great of a team. We struggled a little bit, but I'm trying to remember how it worked in Columbus. I think there were some injuries in Columbus. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember who the goalie was. There's a young French kid and I'm blanking on his name. He was a high draft pick.
Pascal Leclerc.
Yeah.
He had every injury you could possibly have.
Yeah. Which for a middle-aged guy trying to make it back to the NHL, you know, no offense to Pascal, but you know, maybe it helped me a little bit. Right. I got back up there and I was still a backup goalie and didn't play much. But it kind of got me moving around, got me, you know, back up in the NHL. I ended up getting traded at the deadline to Buffalo, who traded, Marty Baron to Philly, I think.
So that'd I was in the right time frame. Yeah.
At that time I was Ryan Miller's backup and was with them through the conference finals, lost in the conference finals. And then in the summer signed with Pittsburgh. And then from there, started the year in Wilkes-Barre. Really, actually, had a great time in Wilkes-Barre. We had a decent team.
They were always good back then. They always put a good American League team out.
Yeah, Todd Richards was our coach. I mean, I was having a really good time. Fleury got hurt. I don't know if it was in late October, early November, what it was. I went up, and then I was up for the rest of the year. And then ended up signing with Detroit after that and kind of bounced around. But it was – you know, I ended up in two pretty good spots. Certainly, Pittsburgh was a really good spot. And it was a young team. Again, there was an injury that, you know, kind of gave me a chance to get back up to the NHL. But a lot of it was I had been playing a lot of hockey, too, in the American League. You know, I was playing almost every night.
Yeah, you're in the groove, right?
Right. And that's important, too, because, you know, as my career, you know, kind of towards the end of it, I wasn't playing a lot. You know, it's tough to stay sharp.
Yeah.
And I found that even going back to the minors, you know, which I did my last year in Detroit for probably 8 or 10 games, it might have been a little bit more than that, was helpful. I played well when I came back. So, but yeah, I was lucky. I'd play a lot of hockey and I, you know, was fortunate to get opportunities to get back up and play some more.
You rattled off a couple of names, Ryan Miller, Marc-Andre Fleury, You've had some pretty awesome goalie partners that, I mean, yeah. Looking at that way, I mean, one, what makes a really good goalie partner? And two, some of your favorites throughout your career.
Boy, you could probably do this list just as well as I could, but, I think that I see. So I, most of my career, I was the one who needed to, I was a backup goalie my career, you know, where I had stints where I'd play more, but by and large, basically I was just a backup goalie all my career. So I kind of had to be a good teammate, you know, and being a good teammate is, it's different, I think, when you're a backup goalie for a guy who's clearly a starter. So I'll take like me and Yaroslav Halak as an example. I'm there to push Yaro. I was there to push Yaro, but I wasn't necessarily there, you know, like you want to like fight for time, but there's a big difference between fighting for time and then trying to steal the guy's job.
Yeah.
You know, taking a job over happens in sports all the time. But it felt like, my job was to be a good teammate to Yaro or be a good teammate to whoever I was backing up at the time, Ryan Miller, right? I'm not trying there to, with the intention of taking Ryan Miller's job. Nobody was going to do that at that time anyway. So yeah. Being a good teammate, you know, like being ready, you know, to go in if the game got to like 4-0 or 5-0, you know, and he needed a break, get in there and maybe give him a night off or, whatever it is to be a good teammate. I don't know. It's so that was kind of like, that's what I thought being a good partner was. And then you would expect that same thing back, you know, when you're playing, you expect the guy to be in your corner and, you know, be a good teammate. I had a lot of really good goalie partners, you know, Jimmy Howard in Detroit was really fun. Between Jimmy and Jimmy Bedard, who was our goalie.
Like you guys, there's no way you didn't have fun.
Trying to keep those two. Oh God. We had some good times.
Well, and then you had Osgood in the mix a little bit, right?
Ozzy is like, is his own unique animal. It's like, it's those guys are great. They're great. And you know, they're true professionals, right? But they're really, you know, they're just good down to earth guys, all three of them. Chris Mason in St. Louis, amazing guy. I had a lot of, I really like Flower.
Yeah. He said the same thing about you.
Yeah. He's such a good guy. I mean, he's just such a, like, just a sweetheart, you know, and just such a nice guy. I never had a partner I just did not like that I can think of that I did not like.
Yep.
Enjoyed everybody. UC Markkanen was an awesome guy.
Well, he's Finnish.
He was a good dude. I like UC.
Well, ironically, your NHL fight was against a Finn, Pasi Nurminen.
Yeah.
Jesus. How did that even happen?
So Byron Defoe started the game.
It's against the Atlanta Thrashers.
Byron Defoe started the game. And we'd gone up probably... I can't even remember what the score was. Enough where Byron got hurt. That's what it was. Byron got hurt in the second or third period. Or I think he got hurt at the second pass. He came in the third. And we went up 4-1 or something. It was kind of late in the game. And they put out the big guys. And we had, we had George on the ice, Laroc.
Oh.
He'd be a handful for any two guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't have like little guys in the ice either. And it turned into a line brawl. And we ended up meeting up at center ice. So frankly, I broke my hand. I had been playing pretty well at that point and had started to play more games and ended up breaking my hand and missing like 3 or 4 weeks.
Did you break it on his face?
No, not on his face, in the top of his head, I think.
Oh man.
Yeah, it happens and just, you know.
I mean, I've never considered you to be a small guy. And to be honest with you, in your presence, you make me a little nervous because I think you got crazy old man strength and you always have. I mean, you were one of the stronger goalies I can remember skating with. Powerful. Like
I was, it was funny. I tell people I was big when I came in. You're 6'2".
Right. 6'2". We were both big goalies at 6'2".
But I'm not 6'2". I'm barely 6 foot.
That's what it said in the yearbook.
Yeah, I know. I you notice I never changed that.
Right.
I never brought that up. I was a big guy. I was a big, fairly big goalie when I came in. And by the time I left, like there might've been like one or two guys who were shorter than me. Everybody's 6'3", 6'4". I mean, it was amazing how much the game's changed and kind of how you see it too, especially when you get on the scouting side, how advantageous it is for guys with size.
I almost forgot about this and didn't get to it, but the outdoor game specialist.
Yeah.
You played in three of them for three different teams at the point where there hadn't really been outdoor games. I think you played in like the first three. That first one in Edmonton, have you ever been colder in your life? What were the conditions like?
I wasn't that cold necessarily.
Theodore makes it out like it was the coldest he's ever felt ever.
Dude, it was cold. Well, he thinks he was cold. He was getting all the work. Dude, I was the other one watching him.
I mean, you're from Alaska. You've got experience with this.
It was, I feel like I remember, and I could be making this up, but I feel like I remember them giving us a temperature that like, hey, if it's this cold, we're going to have to like postpone it to tomorrow. It's supposed to be a little bit warmer tomorrow. Like, all right. And they told us that like a day or two before. And I remember me waking up and the game was maybe at, memory serves me, it was at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And they played. I know they played the alumni game, which was like Gretzky, Messier, Curry.
Fear was out there kicking.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Right. Like I was like, we all wanted to watch it. I remember waking up at like 9 o'clock in the morning, turned the weather channel on, obviously. It had been cold too. And the weather started, for whatever reason, I got it in St. John's, Newfoundland. So about as far east as you can go. And it moved city by city westward until I got to Edmonton. It got colder every single city. every single city. And I think it had to be minus 20, like at that time of the day. And I walked, I don't know, two blocks. I lived downtown. My wife and I lived in an apartment downtown and walked two blocks to grab some breakfast or something. It was freezing, man. Freezing. So I wasn't necessarily overly cold. My gloves and hands, my gloves got stiff. My hands got cold, but we could replace them. We kind of like, I had two sets. The other set was sitting in, next to a heater on the bench. So we could replace it whenever we wanted. Refs were like, hey, anytime you got to go over the bench, just go over the bench. Between whistles, we'll hold up and let you change stuff. So I was all right that way. It wasn't awesome. It was wearing stuff underneath your gear that you're not used to wearing, so you don't feel right that way.
That's what I was wondering. What did you put on to warm up?
Like a neoprene suit, basically. I mean, it was just like, it wasn't neoprene. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it was like whatever guys, the football teams.
Like you used to see Bruce Smith for the Bills wearing like the ski suit underneath his gear. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, it was, you know, it kept me warm. But the other two, certainly they were still cool, but you know, I could dress normally. You know, you just put like a t-shirt or a long, maybe instead of a short sleeve t-shirt, you put a long sleeve t-shirt, whatever you do. You dress a little bit more normally. But yeah, it was cold. It was cold. I think it was probably worse for the people in the stands.
How was the Pittsburgh game?
That one was fun. It was fun. They were all fun, but that one was fun. Unique. It was kind of like the first winter classic. I know that the one up in Edmonton was the first outdoor game, but there was also a bit of how many years between the next outdoor game? It's like 5 years.
Yeah, it had been a bit. That was a real one-off in Edmonton.
It felt different. And then, it went off so well. You know, the snow, while it wasn't great necessary for playing conditions, kind of like added to the ambiance.
And you had a special mask for it, if I remember right, too.
I had a helmet.
That was kind of like the first wave of everybody dressing up for those games.
I think Ryan wore a hat on top of his helmet like Theodore did.
Right.
Right. I never got it. I never did that. I must have just been, you know, no style on my own. That one, and then to have Sid score the shootout winner in, you know, it just went so well, that it was kind of hard. I remember driving to the rink with, I think I was probably going there with like Ryan Malone and
Bugsy. God. Oh man.
And Whitney, but we got there and I'm like, God, this must be what football players feel like coming in. Cause we were there three and a half hours early.
Right.
And the parking lot was stuffed. People drinking beers. They looked awesome.
They were tailgating like the Steelers game.
Yeah, dude. It was like a Buffalo, like a Buffalo Bills, like the Bills Mafia. We're already right. out. So yeah, it was just cool. It was just really neat.
Did you expect Ryan Whitney to have all the success he's had, like with Chicklets and become this big media personality?
Well, I'm not surprised. I don't know. You know, I see that I don't necessarily follow that stuff that much, but I know that he's doing really, I mean, he's been very successful.
He's crushing it.
Yeah, I'm sure he is, but.
Conks, he's got a vodka named after him in every single liquor store across North America.
He's a unique kid. I like him. He's fun. Yeah, he was really fun in Pittsburgh. He's just a funny guy. You know, he's just like up for a good time all the time.
Same way with Bugsy. I was with Malone in Tampa Bay. God, yeah, he was fun to be around. So the Detroit outdoor game, they're all fun for different reasons. There's another notorious moment. How'd the bathroom break go down?
Well, that's the thing is like I would take I would go to the bathroom in the first, like the second or intermission, like the halfway through the first period, pretty much every game I ever played. It's just like, I don't know if I never really got it down, like how much water to drink, how much water not to drink, when to take a leak. I don't know. I just, for whatever reason, I always had to go to the bathroom. That game is, I hadn't drank as much, hadn't sweat as much, whatever it was. It was like the third period. And it wasn't that far away. And the breaks were like 2.5 minutes.
At Wrigley Field.
It probably looked odd, but nobody would have known if Panger hadn't said anything. No right. one would have known. And I would have nice and quiet and just kept it to myself. And Panger had to wrap me up.
What I want to know about it is that, did you get to piss in a trough? Because at Wrigley Field, they don't have urinals for the fans. Was it different underneath the stadium where you were?
It was, yeah, it was like an old urinal.
Okay, man, that's kind of disappointing.
It was an old urinal because it was like in the bubbles. It was like when you go down into the dugout.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about at baseball stadiums, those big troughs. I think that's one of Jimmy Bedard's favorite memories of you. Do you have any favorite ones of him?
Of Jimmy?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus. Jimmy was, I don't know how.
Longtime Detroit Red Wing goalie coach. He was with me in the Texas Stars a few years later.
I could probably give you some offline. he's just, I just remember him being so right and wrong in your corner as a coach. Like it was crazy. Like he was always on your side.
Yep.
Even when you were playing poorly, and he would tell you when you weren't playing well. But I mean, he would go to bat for you. Like that's when I talk about, you know, like coaches who have been around, who have a lot of experience, you know, he knew exactly what you're feeling all the time before you knew what you were feeling. It was great. So I learned a lot from him that way.
He got me in the best mental state of my career.
Yeah.
Like when we were deep in a playoff run, we went to game seven in the Calder finals and nobody throughout my career got me in a better mental state to prepare for the game.
Yeah.
That's funny. Cause like at one point I made a save through the year that I don't know whether I stacked it or it was upside down or what. And I was just jokingly, I was like, yep, went full peacock on that. Yeah. and I'll never forget before game seven of the Calder Cup finals, Jimmy comes up to me and he goes, full peacock, Mikey, just let him. And he's, by the way, I hate being called Mikey. He's like one of the few guys on earth I'll let say it. He's like, he goes, full peacock, you got to let those feathers fly. And then, and I was like, so he got a laugh out of me and he just like got me in the moment for it, man. Like,
yeah, that's good. So it was just that one year with Jimmy you had?
Just one. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good man. He's a good man.
That season was the second time you saved my career. And I say this kind of facetiously, right? I don't think he actually really truly saved it, but there were two moments though where your advice really helped me. And this one, I remember calling you up and I was just struggling, right? Like, and I couldn't really figure it out because I felt like I was playing well, but goals were still going in. And I was just overdoing it, right? I was overthinking. Mm-hmm. And you, at one point, again, you just deadpanned, you cut me off and you go, you need to go out there and just not give a fuck, man.
Yeah.
And that was your advice. And well, for things that I've had somebody say to me, that's so like bang on to the point. Yeah. I use that all the time now with kids that I help, that like, when you said that, what's the true meaning behind it?
Well, I think the true meaning is that like, it is a game. And I don't know if you ever, if you ever think back, I can't think of any time that I was playing well and not having fun. And conversely, very few times that I was playing poorly and having fun. Right. So
totally agree.
So, you know, I find that, what happened to me was I was really struggling. I can't even remember when it was in my career. There was one or two times like where I was just really struggling. And it got to the point where it's like, hey, you know, you've done everything you can to prepare, you know, you're get all the bad self-talk out of your head and just go out and have fun. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. That's kind of the way when I say, you know, you don't give a fuck, I don't really mean it that way, but you know, just go out and have fun.
Right.
It's kind of what I'm trying to get at. And I believe this is from experience. I've been there, you know, where you just work yourself up so much and it's such a hindrance on any type of performance.
It's kind of hard to explain that to kids in some ways, because they hear that and they're like, what do you mean? You shouldn't care. And it's like, no, like we understand that you care, but you have to play like you just are completely free and you don't have anything else you're worrying about. It's just like, it's kind of like that clear the mechanism moment from that Kevin Costner baseball movie where, you know, all you're focused on is just what's in front of you, you know?
But I think it really does help to have struggle. And it's more impactful if you're struggling, because you could say, oh, I just don't care, you know, when everything's going well. Mm-hmm. It's when you're struggling and you can't really, like you said, you can't really pinpoint what the problem is. Right. You know, you feel like you're preparing correctly. You feel like, you know, you're positionally, you're in good spots. I'm kind of just talking about goalies, but it works for anybody in any position, any sport, really. And it's just not happening for you, you know? So if you kind of just like relax a little bit and maybe don't give quite as much of a fuck, and it helps out. I'm glad it worked for you.
I mean, it changed my whole season. I went from, and that after we talked, I think it was like late November, beginning of November, I had the highest save percentage in the league for the rest of the year.
Well, that's
perfect. I was swimming with like credit card numbers. And then I was like a 940 the rest of the year. And we went to the finals, best hockey I ever played. You know,
how'd you like Austin?
The best. Like, well, Portland, Maine, which, I mean, you know Portland pretty well. Mm-hmm. Portland, Maine, and Austin were my two favorite cities.
Portland's a great spot.
But if I had to actually like pick one of those two American League cities to live in, it'd be Austin.
Really?
Well, Portland's like, I love Portland, but man, it is cold a lot of the year.
You know, so. Portland's like 50 miles north of me.
Yeah, in Portsmouth. Yeah.
Yeah.
2007-08, you're with the Pittsburgh Penguins. 2008-09, you're with the Detroit Red Wings.
Yeah.
To the powerhouses in hockey. Does it sting to have not gotten a cup?
I guess when I went from Pittsburgh to Detroit, I really realized how good that team was. That team in Pittsburgh was outstanding, really good. The team in Detroit, man, it's just like the experience level was off the charts. I thought we were going to win for sure when I was in Detroit the second year.
So did Marian Hossa.
Yeah, I know. Right.
Package deal.
I know. Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. You know, I'd only go there if he came, but I thought we were going to win for sure, but it was, you know, they're great experiences. It is, you know, a little bit of, it would have been nice for sure. Obviously that's the big piece of pie, obviously. But you know, like I was obviously the backup for all that stuff. So it's not like, I guess it's not like I had a lot of control over it, unfortunately. And sure, nothing would have changed had I been in net, but it was certainly like to have the opportunity to kind of like be that close to everything and see it up close like that. The different ways every organization handled it too. And all of them, you know, it's like Detroit was, it was amazing. It was like, it was, you might as well have been in regular season a lot of time. Guys ramp up their play, obviously, and the intensity ramps up, but the way guys acted was no different. I mean, it was clear they'd been there. You know, all those guys, you know, Draper, Maltby, Lidstrom, Datsyuk, Zetterberg, all these guys, all these great players with so much experience. It's clear that it was like, you know, they were just used to it. They were used to that success.
So hypothetical, if you had to face a breakaway, whether it was Datsyuk or Crosby, which one would you rather face?
I feel like as great of a player as Sid is, Pav has the opportunity to make me look worse. Does that make sense?
Datsyuk can make you look foolish. You might end up in the corner and he's got a layup. Was he as like just as sick in practice as games, Datsyuk?
He's amazing. Yeah. He was one of them. I mean, it's just such a skilled guy and hard worker. So, I mean, really, I mean, he was on the ice, you know, late every day, worked hard in the gym. Guy was consummate professional, always prepared, always ready. Yeah. And he was stronger than he looked too. Yeah. He was a great player. He was a great player. Lidstrom was unbelievable.
Must've been nice to play behind him, huh?
Amazing. It's like go an entire season, it didn't feel like he ever made a mistake.
Yeah. He never got hit.
That whole team, there were so many guys like that, you know. I mean, guys had just been so good for so long. You know, I was really lucky to play with a lot of really, really good hockey players in my career. And guys who just, you know, accomplished so much, but you know, they all worked so hard for it. So
I always liked your sense of humor. I've admired that about you. And I think that really came through during your time in St. Louis. Like there were Facebook groups dedicated to it. There were memes floating around about it, but you had like, it was Ty Conklin's hat was literally like a thing in St. Louis where you wore this retro blues hat. You had a Fu Manchu going at the time. Your style was off the charts. You just needed a backup towel to complete the ensemble.
I feel like I got the backup towel once in a while.
Okay. So you carried that tradition. Where the hell did you find that hat in St. Louis?
Wasn't my hat. It was Oshie's hat. I think it was Oshie's hat. I think it was TJ's hat. And I just wore it because I had a god awful ugly mustache.
And what was the inspiration for that?
I had a beard before and I just
just wanted to run it.
There was no real inspiration, you know. I think if you notice, most of the times, anytime I had that, they didn't last very long. My wife would only allow it for a couple of days, and she's like, you got to get rid of it.
Teammates loved it.
Yeah. I was lucky. I could grow a mustache and I could grow a beard.
That hat was sick though. Like when you put that thing on, were you feeling it?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt it all the time, but yeah, that hat definitely that hat helped. It was only for a little bit though. I don't know what happened to it. I think I shaved my mustache and then Osh was like, no, it's not the same. Can't have it anymore.
So last year you go back to the Detroit organization. Did you have any inkling that it might potentially be your last season? Were you starting to feel the clock winding down at that point?
Yeah. Big time. St. Louis, my second year, hadn't played a lot. That not playing a lot carried over into Detroit, and it just kind of, I didn't feel confident at all year long. So I wasn't necessarily surprised. I mean, I was pretty sure that halfway through the year that it was, I wasn't, you can have a poor year. I feel like in the NHL 1 year and get another job. But if you start having multiple poor years as a guy who goes from city to city, you're going to run out of chances. Yeah. And I think that's where I got. It wasn't necessarily a physical thing as it was. I just wasn't playing at all. Cause when I went to the minors that year, I think, you know, probably with like a month or two left in the season, I played well. You know, I got some games under my belt and I played well.
Grand Rapids is a fun place to play.
Good place to play. Great city. So yep. Shockingly good city.
Undercover good city. You ever been to the Bob? You've probably been to the Bob.
I have. Yeah. And then, played well and went back up and played well when I went back up. So it was more of a, it was more of a, I actually look back on that night. I remember thinking, you know, if I knew then what I knew now, I think at the beginning of that year, I would have, the problem is it puts a burden on the club, but from a selfish standpoint, personal standpoint, probably good to go down and play, you know, every month or two when you're only playing two times a month, play a couple games down the minors. It's hard to get your, you know, ego to accept that.
Yeah.
Probably for a lot of guys, but long run might keep you in the league for a year or two more. Would have kept me in the league for a year or two more.
So when did you know for sure? When were you ready to step away from the game?
So the next year was lockout, right?
12-13 was. Yeah.
12-13 was lockout. So, and it started up it was difficult for me to get a job in Europe because I was looking to play in Europe the following year.
Populated market.
Right. Exactly. Like the market was flooded. He was waiting for, Henrik Lundqvist and, you know, Roberto Luongo to come play for their team. Yeah. Guys, I'll come all year long. But I was being more picky on where I wanted to play than I should have been. I probably should have gone somewhere, but in any event, league started up and I think I set a date for like middle of February, like right around now. I said, if I don't have a job in now, I'm going to go on a ski trip. I had a bunch of buddies from Minnesota. We're going out to Montana, going skiing. I said, if I don't have a job by then, I'll go skiing and that'll be it. And I went skiing.
Which for a hockey player is amazing because we usually don't go skiing during the season.
I'll get to go skiing. So went out there with some buddies for three, four, 5 days and that was it. And then it was that year that I came down and I was skating with you in Peoria.
That's right.
And Doug called me that year. And because when they started up, Corey Hirsch was kind of like bouncing. He was mostly in Peoria. And then he started bouncing too much and you didn't have much help down there.
Yeah. Jake Allen and myself were there and we were kind of on our own and doing our own goalie coaching.
Yeah. So I came down and at that point, I mean, I wasn't a whole lot of help, I'm sure. But I just come down and, you know, it's nice to have somebody down there spending time with you.
100%. Yeah.
So, and then it went on for like 4 or 5 years and, you know, did that stuff with the Blues, which was fun too.
When you look back at your career, what are you most proud of?
Definitely most proud of, you know, like playing at the highest levels for sure. And for longer than I guess I would have ever expected. I felt like I had some really good years. I had some tough years, but I think I'm about as proud of making it back to the NHL after, you know, early success and then early struggles. And then having to go back and kind of like reinvent myself and get myself back in the NHL. And then for 3, 4, 5 years being, you know, pretty effective. I think for everybody, working through those difficult times and, you know, kind of like succeeding after is a pretty, that's what you want to see out of your kids is, you know, them put that work in and, you know, they see the fruits of that work too. So I think I'm as proud of that as anything, I would say.
Probably saving my career a couple times ranks that, up that there. Too, so
that's a close second for sure.
Man, this has been fun. Thanks for taking an hour of your day to do this.
That was my pleasure. It's nice to see you again.
Big thanks to Ty Conklin for joining the show. The man who twice saved my career. If you enjoy 6 Degrees, please subscribe and rate in iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to all your podcasts. If you're interested in advertising on 6 Degrees, please contact Believe at BLEAV.com. As always, you can find me at MikeMcKenna56 on all the socials, and make sure to check out at McKennaInGame on Twitter. Do live breakdowns of games across the NHL on occasion. Those are a lot of fun. So thanks again for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. See you next time.